Smarter than your average bear. Okay, my question is going to lead directly into this.
Yeah, I didn't have one for this.
Okay. Do you ever... So I'm driving here, and the freeway is right next to the airport, and I'm watching a plane come into land the opposite direction I'm driving. Do you ever just kind of look at that and be like, man, that thing is traveling really slow? Like, it doesn't seem like... Even if you're passing it going the opposite direction, when you come in for a landing, you're just looking at it, and because it's further away from you, you're like, that doesn't look like that should be able to stay up there at that speed. Like, those things are so fucking heavy, that looks like that should have to... And then that gets me thinking, at what, like, how did it go? Like, plane technology even start to exist? Like, you know, it was first when man looked at birds and then tried to do, like, a paraglider or, like, a... What's the... Is it a paraglider? The one where you kind of, like...
Hang glider?
Hang glider, yeah. And then it was just finding a way to then put a motor on that. Of course, and then all the advancement was driven by war. Because if they're like, if we can get above our enemies, we can, you know, we can spot where they're at. We can attack them from the air. So that technology was driven by war. But now we just have... Air travel is so just common. We don't think of how just incredibly amazing that is, that you can get from here to there, traveling in a metal cylinder strapped with fucking rocket engines, and be so precise about it. And landing and taking off is just the most normal occurrence ever. You're basically bringing this thing down at hundreds of miles an hour. And it's just like, we've arrived at our destination. Thank you for flying with us. We're flying 8 more times today.
The first thing that I'll admit, and I'm not even embarrassed to admit it, and I'll never understand it. I don't understand flying. Like, I understand, like, there's lift versus drag and all that shit. Mm-hmm. Like, all the terms of how it works, I understand. There's still something that just feels magic about it.
Yes. The basic principle behind it, in the 30-second to 60-second explanation, when the flaps go down into this and you start descending, when they're pointing down, you're creating more pressure underneath the wing because you're keeping the wind trapped there. When it raises up above the wing to start your descent, it's keeping more air pressure above that. It's like the whole thing when you put your hand out the window. Except when you put your hand out the window and you dip your hands down, you're going up.
I do know, though, that no matter how strong my arm is, it'll never be able to lift the car. And that's what I just, there's no logical sense that it makes.
The science and physics behind it, my mind does not comprehend that. And I feel like I'm pretty smart. I just don't have that mathematical lift equation, gravity, all that kind of stuff, speed that can calculate it. And the only person I know that is a pilot does not seem like the kind of person that has that kind of mind either.
He's just plane goes up, plane goes down kind of guy. I know how to make that happen.
It basically flies itself. Uh-huh. All I have to do is get on the intercom and make a joke.
Try not to say anything bad. Yeah, I don't get it. I enjoy flying. I've kind of like the sick, morbid way. I think I've told you about it, but I come from a family of people that didn't enjoy flying so much. And I have just kind of made my deal with getting on the plane. Like, I'm not afraid of it because I just know that, like, anytime I fly, I've just signed a contract. Like, if we land, we land. If we die, we die.
Yeah.
It's the most black and white thing that I've ever thought of.
I'm playing the lottery right now, but I have super good odds. So good of odds. I'm not ever hesitant enough not to step on this plane.
It's a reverse lottery. Yeah. It's the exact opposite.
I get it. Like, people that are so used to flying, they never give it a second thought. That's kind of foreign to me. But like, when I step on a plane, I'm always a little bit, not taken back, but it always is a little bit when you get that acceleration to start taking off and you're just like, oh yeah. And then you kind of feel the bumps and everything. You're like, oh yeah, this is, you know, this isn't just smooth and automatic. Like, there's someone up there that's controlling this and getting us in the air. And
like, turbulence in the air, it's just like, okay, well, if this is how I go out, I guess this was the decision that I made. Like, at least it's going to be a little bit exciting.
Yeah, but like, imagine, so like, early on, so during like World War I, when planes were first implemented, that kind of gave the rise to more like, not commercial, but like civilian airliners. And then World War II, I forget, in Europe during World War II, you also had commercial flights that were still flying around and operating out of airports, plus having all of the military planes doing bombing targets and all that kind of stuff. The first hijacking... Do you know when the first hijacking of an airplane took place, a commercial airplane?
It was in like the 50s, wasn't it?
48.
1948?
So like, commercial air flight had barely been invented and someone was already hijacking a plane. Okay.
I don't know.
This is even more amazing. okay, let's fast forward a little bit to 68.
Yeah, before that, the first commercial airline in the U.S. was 1926.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. World War I, you start flying people around the country because you find it's a viable, quick way, and it's relatively safe.
I don't think it was that safe, though. I think up until probably like the 60s, like you were talking about.
Think of it this way. The reason I felt that it was, of course, safe, not by our standards today, but relatively safe because imagine like if you had something that you were researching and instead of taking a long time to research it to make it safe, you had so many resources in order to test and, you know, make it viable within a short time span. So like World War One is when airplanes were first introduced. All of our resources or a huge portion of it weren't researching that. So it's not like you just had Uncle Bob designing a plane engine. You had all of these companies designing the best of the best. And then all of a sudden commercial flight was kind of birthed out of that.
Yeah. I think that it was much more dangerous though.
Like, I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm saying it's safe relative to the time.
Safe relative to the time. Yeah. I would think that a car trip would be safer than a plane trip.
Oh, I agree with you. But if you need to get somewhere quick or you have important like assets that you're trying to move, you might risk it going on a plane.
It's a matter over convenience is safety.
Correct. And at this point, there's no such thing as airport security.
No.
You're literally just walking up to the ticket counter and being like, I'd like to buy a ticket to this place, please. And they're like, well, we have this flight leaving at this time. Here's my money. I don't even know if they checked IDs. All the way up to the point in... Do you have anything before? Okay.
Mm-mm. I'm so surprised that we're like coming up on the 100-year anniversary of commercial airlines. That's yeah. A pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And kind of what you were talking about as far as like military leads to commercial flights. I think there's a branch off the tree where people stopped necessarily doing all the military stuff because that was more like design for that action.
Mm-hmm.
There was more research and development going into the private sector of saying like, hey, how can we make these bigger? How can we make these safer?
Man.
Do all that?
You try to find the quickest route to making the most amount of money and making it profitable. But between up until 68, between 68 and 71, guess how many commercial hijackings there were in a 3-year time span?
I think I saw 50s to 70s. So 300?
They said 50s to 70s that?
Okay, I'm just going to go into 3 years. 50s to 70s was like 1,000.
Okay, so that 3-year span, 68 to 71, there were over 100 commercial hijackings. Like, can you imagine if hijacking reports of a plane hijacking were just so common? That's one. If it's 100 in a 3-year times, that's 36 months. Is that 3 a month almost? Almost 3 a month.
It would be way more than that.
Mm-mm.
If you have 112 months?
No, not 100. It's 36 months. 3 years would be 36 months.
Okay, yeah. I was
doing 100, for a year. It's almost 3 a month. But it would just be like, another plane got hijacked today.
And there's less flights.
Yes.
Like, now there's a million flights. Back then, like, you have a better chance at sailing across the entire world, like across the entire ocean and not running into pirates than you do running into a sky pirate.
Yes.
I would be a lot less inclined to fly. If I had to fly in the 50s, I'd be like, I'll walk.
What's nuts to me is that this event is the one that just happened to kind of birth all of these FAA, I guess maybe even the creation of like the security portion of the FAA and kind of the airport security as we know it and procedures are almost kind of from this situation.
Well, and from what I saw, don't quote me on it, but I think this is the only skyjacking that's never been solved.
It is the only skyjacking that is unsolved. So, on November 24th, 1971... a man named Dan Cooper walked into the Portland airport and purchased with cash a one-way ticket to Seattle. He was going to be on Northwest Orient Airlines, which...
niche airline.
I know, but I don't get... why do you have Orient in there? What do you think when you think Orient?
Japan.
They might have China and Japan?
They might have flown back because That's the other thing that I don't get is I think it's only like a couple hours longer to go from like Seattle to Japan than like California to Hawaii. I don't think it's that much longer. Like Hawaii.
Are you talking about with like a time change?
Just like the distance between Japan and Hawaii is not as far as
I think. Yeah, when you look at the globe, it's weird because like it goes, I don't know. I don't know about that. So it's a 30-minute trip. Dan Cooper is described as a white male, mid-40s, dark hair and eyes. He's wearing a black or brown business suit, which I think you would notice the difference between black or brown being that these people were, there were people with this entire time.
There's probably like eight colors back then.
Yeah, white shirt, then black tie, black raincoat, brown shoes. I don't know, you're putting black and a lot of black and brown together depending on this suit. And a black attaché briefcase, which is the cool one you always see with the little locks on it and the little...
Attaché sounds so much cooler than briefcase.
I know. Military attaché. So he gets sat in the back row, and I know the name Dan Cooper might not ring a lot of bells because that was a fake name that he gave, but he's known by a different name kind of in popular culture. That was kind of a mistake to begin with, but then it just kind of got run with.
I don't know about the mistake.
Okay, do you want to talk about that later?
Yeah.
Okay, so most people know this as D.B. Cooper. So D.B. Cooper, the only man to, well, I guess not the only man to hijack a plane, but the only unsolved plane hijacking currently. I don't think there's probably going to be another one.
God, I hope not. It's the perfect crime, though. As far as, like, crime doers go, I'm pro-DB.
Well, it turned into a situation. It could have gone, well, I don't think it could have gone badly as far as, like, a loss of life. Because I think what he had wasn't really what he had.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
But I can talk, you can talk about this with no risk because no one got hurt.
Yeah, and victimless crime. You can simply
just be amazed at the balls of this dude.
Truly, just, the only person that could have been hurt in this scenario was him.
Yes. Well, I mean, I guess if some of his information was incorrect, then maybe somebody else could have, but his information wasn't incorrect, so. Yeah, no one ended up getting hurt. Oh, did I just.
I still see green light.
No. We're good. I just accidentally unplugged my headphones.
What does that mean? Yeah.
Yep. Technical difficulties. Hang on.
Oh, there we go. That's better. So just the simple fact he could walk into an airport. Oh, and by the way, when he went in to get on this flight, no TSA security.
No bag checks.
No bag check. No nothing. So
literally, like you said, he filled out a form at the desk.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have to show ID because he told them his name was Dan Cooper. Mm-hmm. That was how easy it was.
Yeah.
And not only that, this was a time, I don't know when the law was put into effect. I want to believe it was earlier, but I think it was probably pretty late. He brought on a pack of cigarettes too, and was smoking cigarettes on the plane.
Oh, that was a normal thing for a long time. They would have different sections of the plane that you could smoke in and just assume that wasn't going to filter in this metal tube.
There's some sort of magic going on. Mm-hmm.
So he sits in the last row, back toward the back of the plane, orders a bourbon and 7-Up.
Good choice.
Yeah. So crew was 6, 37 passengers on this flight, and right after the flight takes off, one of the stewardesses, or flight attendants, they were stewardesses at this point, but flight attendants, Florence Schaffner, DB, she leans down, he passes her a note, she puts it in her pocket or whatever she has. At this point, too, you got to keep in mind that flight attendants were probably propositioned by businessmen, which he was completely dressed as, all the time. Like, hey, here's where I'm traveling. Here's where my number. Here's where I'm going to be staying at my hotel. She doesn't pay any mind to it. She literally just takes it, doesn't even open it, puts it in her pocket.
How gross of a time would that have been? That, like, that's her move with that.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah, just that it was so casual that she was just like, I know where this goes. So
99% of flight attendants were probably female back then.
So she's by the jump seat, the fold down seat right behind him. So he sees that she doesn't look at it. And so he kind of leans out to her and he goes, ma'am, you may want to read that note. I have a bomb. And she's like, I guess at this point, because there's been so many hijackings, she seems relatively calm about this, but she's like, okay. And he's like, I'd like you to come sit next to me. And so she comes over, sits next to him, and she's like, okay, can I see it? He's like, yeah. So he opens his briefcase, and in there are four red cylinders. Sorry, sticks. Like taped together with some wiring and then like a circular battery or something like that. It seems like a Wile E. Coyote type.
Dynamite, baby.
Mm-hmm. Here's the thing why I say it wasn't. Because apparently dynamite is not red. Road flares are red. They've always been red. Dynamite is this pale orange color. And the reason they do that is because they made them separate colors to make the distinction between the two of them. So one of them is a dark red, like we always see in the Wile E. Coyote mm-hmm. Looney Tunes. The other ones are actually... And come on, think of it this way. It's just a battery wired to some, like...
Still not buying it.
Okay.
Those are two very different items. A flare and a piece of dynamite. Why in the world would you be like, hey, let's make this one red, and just to discern between the two of them, let's make this one a little yellow
we'll
or red.
We'll agree to disagree.
Like, make the shit black.
Okay, here's the thing. TNT it doesn't have an impact black. On. Okay, I understand that. It doesn't have an impact on the story, though.
No.
Because she looks at it, and she's like, okay, even if I suspected that that wasn't, it looks close enough, and I'm not a bomb expert. So she sits down next to him, and what's the list of demands that he had?
The list of demands were $200,000 in cash, four parachutes, and that he wanted a refueling truck mm-hmm. on the tarmac mm-hmm. so they could refuel and take off because he wanted to head down to Mexico. And I don't know, this will sort of lend into the conspiracy theories. I wouldn't think at this point that you would have the understanding because flying from Seattle, Washington to Mexico, that's you're going to have a stop for fuel at that point. I think even now you would have to have a stop for fuel at that point or at this point, right?
Yeah, they would have. Well, I don't think that came into play until he gave them their flight directions. I think they may have had to stop somewhere closer to do a refueling on their like closer to Mexico. But because later, remember, he tells them what they have to fly.
Because they tell him
and
that
he's
it's
like,
not
at
possible.
This speed and range, our range is limited. We're going to have to stop in like Reno, but kind of getting ahead of ourselves. So kind of some things that he did. So he had her write down the demands. And after she had read the note or he told her about the bomb, he took the note back, his handwritten note, took it back from her. So these are just like little weird details that we'll mention just because they kind of all add together kind of the mystery of the whole thing.
He had the initial one that he slipped the note to.
Mm-hmm.
What was her name?
That was Florence Schaffner.
He had Flo sit next to her. And she had gotten the attention of another flight attendant and came over and she said, we need to let the pilots know so they can radio down to the tower. The tower can get the FBI involved.
Get the ball in motion.
So she says, the pilots want to see the notes. DB's like, okay, take the notes.
Well, he knows that she has to take them there because he can't get on the ground without anyone being aware of this and have them pull to the gate and then start making his demands. Because then he's waiting twice as long.
So he wants the prep work to already be done.
Yeah, he wants basically to come down and have all the stuff ready to go
so,
by the time they land. So it limits his interaction or chances of them storming the plane or doing something like that, I'm assuming.
The flight attendant walks up, gives the notes to the pilots. Pilots talk to the flight...
So Tina, one of the main people in this, so you have the initial flight attendant, Florence Schaffner, then the flight attendant that takes her spot after she calls her over, her name is Tina Mucklow. And so she's like, hey, you're going to sit with him. I'm going to go ahead and take the, and so she goes up to the cockpit and I don't think you really ever see Florence come back out to interact. She's now, they're communicating via phone because they're right by the back of the plane to the cockpit. So they have the list of demands read to, you know, SeaTac flight control or whatever, the tower. They patch them in with the police. And then the police, I think because it's an FAA thing, have to then get the FBI involved. So he gives them the $200,000. It was supposed to be in non-negotiable American. Why do they always say that? Like non-negotiable.
Well, I think it's partially.
Or negotiable, not non-negotiable. Negotiable American currency.
When you start talking about 50s and 100s, they put 50s and 100s into circulation a lot less than 20s and 10s and 5s. Oh, so
they're easier to track. I got you.
Yeah. So bigger bills are always going to be easier to track because there's less of them out there.
Oh, right, man. That makes a lot of sense.
And kind of getting back to one of the things that I think made him really brilliant was after they had already read the list of demands, he had the second lady get on the horn and talk to the pilots and tell them that he wanted the notes back. Because the less evidence that you can leave, which kind of contradicts what he does after he makes his exit, the less evidence that you leave as far as handwriting, potential fingerprints, all that kind of stuff, really sort of starts to mask your identity even more than what you do. So it's a brilliant move at that point. The other issue that the flight staff had was they had to make sure not to cause the commotion. So they had to continue on the entire thing. I think you said it was a 30-minute flight.
Yeah.
They had to continue the entire 30 minutes with, like, drink service and everything else to make it feel normal so they weren't causing a big hubbub on the plane.
Well, it wasn't even just – it didn't turn into just the 30-minute flight, because what they ended up having to do is while SeaTac was getting everything together, he wanted them to remain airborne. So they had to circle Seattle and that area for 2 hours.
While they're collecting $200,000 in $20 bills.
Which the FBI was like, oh, yeah, we can get that together. And I think they ended up calling the headquarters for Northwest Orient, too. And the president or whoever was in charge at that point was like, yeah, do it. Like, we have – we're prepared for these situations with the money, actually, because I'm sure that all airlines at this point, because everyone was getting hijacked fucking left and right, would have to have access to ransom money.
And they would have to also sequence the bills to make sure that they had every serial number. They took pictures of,
like, the certain sequences so they could track them later. So the FBI did that. So the other thing he wanted is four parachutes, two front parachutes and two back parachutes. And I've read some conflicting stuff regarding the parachutes. So part of it says that the parachutes he got, you had your military chutes and your civilian chutes. Military chutes, I think at this point, were still just the circular ones where it was just drop chutes to get you just straight down to the ground. Civilian chutes were more the rectangle ones you could control for recreational skydiving. And again, this is still the 70s. Recreational skydiving isn't, like, popular. So you have to go to, like, training schools for flying that they would use chutes if they had to bail out of an aircraft, not for, like, really skydiving. So I've seen reports that the chutes he got, they were acquired from, like, a flight school. So they were all, they weren't military chutes. They were like the reserve chutes that go on your front and then the main chutes that go on your back. And they were the steerable ones. But then I've also seen reports saying, like, one of them was a military, one of them was a dummy chute, like a fucking lame duck training chute. And then two of the other ones were, like, sport chutes.
So when they did the list of demands and they were collecting all of the different items that he needed, they told him that they were waiting, or they told the pilots, and then I'm sure the pilots told him that they were just waiting on the chutes to get there from the military base. He says, no, I need the other chutes. I need the civilian, the...
Like the sport chutes, yeah, or recreational skydiving chutes.
And the main difference is, like you were talking about, the drop canopies are made so as soon as you leave the plane...
They're supposed to be connected to the plane, like that line that you hook up, and it pulls your chute for it, you. It deploys it,
yeah.
And the other ones are the actual rip cord where you pull it from your chest, and you do that yourself.
DB wanted to have control of his chutes because he knew, and whether it was maybe through military service, again, we're getting into the fun conspiracy part of it, but... He knew enough to know that he needed a parachute that he could control that was under his, basically, guiding his watch, as opposed to something as a military chute that's controlled by, like you say, either the pulling of it or it deploys as soon as you jump out.
Well, here's the thing, too, that kind of plays into this is the reason that he also hijacked this plane is because it was a very specific type of Boeing 727, like -100 or something. These planes really aren't in a lot of service today, but I remember actually seeing them is that... Instead of having the engines that were under the wings, there were two jet engines on the back, kind of by the tail.
Really?
Yeah. So they were kind of there. And I mean, they're smaller at 727. But and then underneath the bottom of the plane, there was an actual staircase that came down. And that was for like loading passengers if they needed to, or load stuff into like the galley. They would be able to load it there. So that happened right underneath the tail.
Like a service
stairway. Yeah, and so he picked this type of plane because he knew he would be able to parachute and lower that. He also had the knowledge to know that that could be lowered.
Interesting.
And the plane could still fly. It would depressurize the cabin, but then that's why you also fly to lower altitude. The thing about the military chutes is if you see in like any like World War II movies or anything like that, they're actually connected to the plane like a line inside the plane. So when you jump, that's the... friction point. That's where it holds it. And then as you descend from the plane, it pulls your chute out.
It ripcords it for you, basically.
What would he have to hook that to? Like, would he be looking like he's like, do I hook it to the stairs? Do I hook it to the railing? Like, so he would want to have a chute that he could get away from the plane a little bit before he wanted to deploy it, I would imagine.
And more control on landing.
Being once he able had to guide steer it in the air.
So very interesting tidbits that he puts in there. They finally land after circling the airport, and they said, just to try to keep everybody else's minds at ease, they said that there were had some sort of a malfunction going on. They had to burn off a little fuel, which at that point, and if I hear a plane talk about burning off fuel, there's only one reason that you burn off fuel, and that's for less fire when you hit the ground. Mm-hmm. So I'd have panicked at that point, but maybe these people
what sounds good, like, you guys, hey, we'll just tell me it's a mechanical problem. Like, what do you mean a mechanical problem? Be specific. Like a wing?
Is there a light out, an or engine? Is it like a landing gear?
Yeah, we have a light out in the laboratory. We're just going to burn off a bunch of gas.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Good. That good. Makes sense.
Glad to hear it. Let's not drop the shit out of there. Let's burn the expensive stuff. But we finally get on the ground and
park away from the terminal. Yep. The pilot suggests it too. He's like, hey, is it okay if we kind of like stay back from the terminal, like away from everything? And then like the fuel trucks can meet us, and then like a staircase can. He's like, yeah, good idea.
If it's a literal bomb that this guy's thinking of, minimize damage. I think it was Flo, the first flight attendant, gets off, goes over.
It's Tina.
Oh, is it Tina?
Tina, I think at this point kind of serves.
She took over as the primary.
She serves as kind of the liaison. So he basically says, hey, you're going to need to get off, get the money, get the parachutes, bring it back on. Once I have all of that, then I'm going to go and let the passengers off. And then at that point, we'll need to refuel or be refueling at this time and then take back off. So the pilots aren't going anywhere. And then I don't even think he really requests that Tina stays or anything like that, but I think they just kind of all stay as a group.
He tells them that they need to stay up in the cockpit during the takeoff again. One of the things that he says that he needs during takeoff is that he needs, and it's basically like a second list of demands, but he needs that back stairwell that Chris was talking about. He needs that down on takeoff. He also needs them to stay below 10,000 feet, and he needs them to keep it under 200 miles an hour.
The minimum airspeed, he keeps it, the minimum stall airspeed above a stall, it's 115 miles an hour.
So you have 85 miles an hour to play with?
No, no, no. What I'm saying is that's not the stall. That's what he has them go at. It's 10,000 feet at 115. Like, I don't know if I've been 115 miles an hour outside of an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the fact that that's achievable for a mid-level sports car pretty easily kind of is like, that's fast enough to keep a plane.
Again, magic. I don't understand it.
It's devilry. Sky devilry.
It's something that I'll never get. I'll never understand. And these things are like not normal flight precautions, I would say. Like, they always fly above 10,000 feet. Usually it's like 50,000 feet, something like that, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely. It's got to be a lot higher than... So he basically needs to stay at an altitude where it's still the plane can be depressurized, because he's going to have that back door open. And he even requests that. He's like, hey, I want you to take off with this door open. And they're like, we actually can't take off with the door open. He's like, no, I know you guys can take off with the door open. They're like, what about this? How about we get off the ground and then you can lower it right after?
We'll teach you how to open it.
Yeah. And he's like, oh, okay. As long as it can open.
Either or, whatever you do.
Yeah.
And you're going to need enough oxygen in the air to be able to survive that jump, which I'm sure at 50,000 feet, there's not enough oxygen. No,
that's why that's definitely why you have to stay in that 10,000. We're talking like 10,000 feet is like low to the ground. 10,000 feet is not low to the ground.
Not at all.
But for a commercial airliner, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He also needed it because the higher you get, obviously, the colder that it gets because you're closer to space and all that shit.
It's a survivability area, I guess, is what it is.
He wanted to put it in there, and these are also kind of the specs that you would need to do, like, skydiving.
Mm-hmm.
So, also interesting that he would understand all of these things that need to be done for someone to feasibly escape from an airliner, which he ends up doing.
Well, he ends up... So, they get out there, they get him his money, they get him the chutes. Tina stays on the plane, the pilots stay on the plane. I don't know exactly if Florence stays in the cockpit with the pilots this whole time or if she gets off, but...
The cabin's empty.
Yeah, the cabin's empty. They are taking their time refueling, or it's taking a little bit longer, and he's like, hey, we need to get this show on the road. sorry. I don't know if they kind of took that as a threat or anything like that, but I think he was just basically getting nervous and saying like, hey, I don't want anything funny to happen. Let's get this thing going.
Yeah, longer you're on the ground, the more chance that there is.
Like, are they planning something against me yet to retake the plane? Tina, at one point, was talking to him because they had time to kind of talk while they were circling for the 2 hours, and she was sitting there the whole time. And at one point, either, I don't know if she said something to bring it up, but he was like, I don't have a grudge against this airline, just so you know. He's like, I just have a grudge. So I don't, it's never, of course, since he's never been identified, it's never known what that is or anything. It's just kind of an interesting thing to say when they were talking.
Well, and we'll get into it later when he kind of tries to unmask himself. Maybe it was him, maybe it wasn't.
Yeah.
He was also doing things to where she said that he had a fairly good disposition about him. He was a fairly nice guy. Mm-hmm. She didn't want to push anything.
He was really easygoing. He was courteous and everything. At one point after he got the money, so after they get the money, the gate refueled, they go ahead and take off. The time frame between them taking off and the last time they see him is like 4 minutes. So Tina's back there with him, and as soon as they get taken off, it doesn't take long to get to 10,000 feet before the thing levels off. He even tells them, you know, where to set the flaps at. He knew that much about it to set the flaps to like 15 degrees. About 4 or 5 minutes go by. He's like, okay, I'm ready. We're going to lower the back staircase. She's like, hold on a second. I'm afraid, like, because I'm the one that has to do it, I'm afraid I'm going to get sucked out. Can you, you know, can I go get the pilot's like, come up here and get a safety rope so that way you can tie yourself to something when you open it. And you okay?
Yeah, just noises.
Are those bodily noises?
Yeah.
So she's like, okay, well, can I at least get some paracord out of one of these parachutes? Because at that point, he had only two chutes left. They gave him the $200,000 in like a bank bag, like a burlap bag. He asked for a knapsack, like with a strap on it so he could wear it. They gave it to him in like that bank bag, like the big heavy canvas one. Mm-hmm. So he had to like fashion, he had to end up cutting up one of the parachutes to end up making like a strap for the bag to be able to strap it to himself. So that's one parachute out, whether that's one of the good ones, if there is a thought if only certain parachutes were viable.
Would he have known to use the dummy chute to do
they
that?
They said there was an X on the dummy chute because it was for training.
So ever gone through training, he could have.
But here's the thing is the dummy chute wasn't found on the plane. It was one of the chutes that was taken. That's kind of one of the things they're talking about because they had the pieces of the other chute that he cut up. So he used one of those. And then I think the other chute, she used a bunch of paracord off of to get herself strapped in. Well, what ended up happening is that he was just like, you know what? I'll just do it. I'll figure out, tell me how to open it. And then I'll open it. He's like, why don't you just go up to first class, close the partition and don't come back here.
First class for a 30-minute flight's odd. Mm-hmm. First class for a 30-minute flight, like I get that richer people don't want to be around the peasants ever, but like 30 minutes, you don't even get to enjoy first-class tickets.
Yeah, but it's the plane. It's not where the plane's operating. It's just...
That's fair. That's
true. So I think they said, as they're all sitting in the cockpit, they're sitting there and some time goes by, and the captain rings him on the phone in the back and is like, hey, Dan, we're just checking if you need anything. He's like, nope, and hangs up. At the time that the plane also got hijacked is the military base that's kind of close to the SeaTac airport. They scrambled 3 jets. One of them was like a training jet. 2 of them were like military, actually like active jets. Mm-hmm. The thing is these things have such a high minimum airspeed to stay going because they're jets that they couldn't constantly stay next to the plane to maintain visual. And also I think it was also getting dark.
It was nighttime.
Mm-hmm. So they were having to do these like S formations by the plane, but they were still passing the plane. So there were like minutes at a time when there was no one watching this plane and the back staircase and everything.
They also had tried to send a carrier that had, I think it was like 100 parachuted men that was supposed to be following as well to try to make sure that they could, like, if he did jump, that they would be able to deploy and follow him.
I think
him.
They thought they had more time. Because the flight plan, he was like, we're going to Mexico. And the pilot told him, hey, at this airspeed, we're only going to get to
Reno
and then have to refuel. But at this point, I think they also kind of had the inkling was like, oh, if he's already getting back there by himself, how long are we going to have to wait till
he's asking for parachutes, so he's not planning on making
exactly.
That
and they thought he asked for four, too, because they thought he was going to try to take someone with him and would have chutes for that person, which I don't think he planned that, but I also think he planned to make it look like that.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of deception in this whole entire game.
So
the other thing, too, was it was an FBI guy, I think. He was supposed to fall on by helicopter. And but I don't,
that ended up being too slow.
Yeah.
The helicopter couldn't go fast enough, so you're too fast, you're too slow.
You wouldn't think that a helicopter wouldn't be able to keep up with a commercial airliner.
Maybe not the one they had access to. If it's a military, like think of like,
maybe, yeah.
Think of like in Vietnam movies, it's the Huey.
That has the double on the side and then the blade on the back.
It's the one with like the bubble windows in the front, like the one that they would transport troops in.
Yeah.
Like you always see like in Tropic Thunder when they're trying to, at the beginning of the movie, they're trying to get onto it and it would have like guns sometimes by the doors. So maybe that one just wouldn't. That was more of a troop carrier. So I don't know what helicopter they had.
It just feels like that would be common sense that even if you have to keep it under 200, a helicopter's not going to go that fast.
I know.
And especially at night. Like that's not safe.
I know.
So they ended up scrapping that plan. So the helicopter doubled back.
I mean, did they do this with every hijacking though too?
That's a good question.
There were like 199 or 100 before this. So like you think you would have a system set in place where you would have planes capable of keeping up with, maybe they didn't never had someone try to jump out or be slow like this.
Yeah, it very much could be.
Well, at 8 o'clock, a warning light in the cockpit flashes that the back door has been opened. And then 13 minutes later, this is kind of surprising to me. 727 is a big plane. They feel the plane pitch up. The back of the plane actually like pitch up a little bit and then have to correct the flight. So it doesn't, I'm guessing it's not a big shift, but it's enough where they can physically feel it. And that was the point when he left the plane.
I think planes are made though to have that counterweight of people. So a stairway swinging down with nobody in the back is
probably
going to
be down already for a while. So they were cruising with it down.
Oh, when he jumps out.
So it was just him going out onto the steps. And then that, you know, let's say he weighed 200 pounds.
The force to push down off the steps and
or
jump.
Or even that 200 pounds just leaving that step would actually pitch the plane. Yeah. That seems weird.
Well, and it did say that when that happened, they felt the steps slam down, but then come back up and hit the plane, and then they fell back down. So it could have been that.
That's
but
true.
Either way, it was enough of a jostle to, they knew what happened.
Yeah, and well, the steps were still down because they landed in Reno with them actually down. So, yeah, he jumps at 8:13, and that was the last time anybody saw confirmatively Dan Cooper.
Yeah, once they landed, they gave it a little bit. Pilot got over the intercom, said some things, didn't get an answer. He ends up walking back there. The only thing they find were the two parachutes that he didn't bring that you were talking about. They find a black clip-on tie, and then they find 8 cigarette butts.
Yeah.
And obviously DNA wasn't a thing back then. So I wonder if today, if like they kept them in hopes that they could figure out DNA.
Kept them preserved enough to be able to gather any type of DNA.
Mm-hmm. And also you would have to have collected that person's DNA or something like that to get the match. But they lose him. They completely, he's off the radar. They do everything that they can. He kind of ran into some luck that I don't know if it was luck or he planned it, but as he jumped out, there was a big rainstorm that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they tried to look for him the next day, they couldn't really get out to where they think that he jumped. And they think that he jumped around a town in southern Washington called Ariel. And they had to wait a couple days because the conditions weren't good enough to get out there and look.
Well, they had to like almost reenact it too. Okay. This we're getting in now to where stuff is going to kind of get blurry as far as like what, because a lot of this stuff isn't proven. It's a lot of like speculation, but there's some like logic behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Before we do that, I got to pee.
Okay.
All right. While we take a break from class and take care of some business, you can also take care of some business.
If you don't follow us on Instagram or Twitter already, our Instagram handle is Historically High Pod. That's Historically High POD. And our Twitter is Historically High. That's Historically HI.
All right, and back to our show. All right, and we're back with DB. Okay, so he's jumped. Now we're going to start getting to the clues they have to try to put together, the search. So one thing they did you know they got that SR-71 Blackbird that, like, back in 71, that's the plane that would be, like, the high-altitude surveillance plane?
Like a spy plane?
Yeah, it was sort of. It was the black one that had the two engines and then the really long nose.
And it was kind of small?
No, it was huge.
Oh.
But the cockpit only held two guys. Like, one guy was the pilot and the other guy, like, ran the camera and the surveillance equipment. They ran it all during the Cold War to do photography and stuff like that.
Hmm.
But that's so weird that you would have that plane at the disposal to try to catch this one guy. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that points to, like, what his identity could have been and who he could have been. They did reenactments on this where they took the same type of plane, they took a 200-pound sled, and they flew the same exact course, and when they got to the point, they shoved the sled out, and they were trying to determine whether he could have survived it if the sled would have been hit by the jet wash coming out the back of the plane, and the way that the sled fell would have fallen down far enough to where he wouldn't have been. He could have made it out of the plane. So they put all of this stuff together through reenactments and everything to try to determine if he could have survived.
Do you think that they put so much effort into it because they hadn't not solved one yet? Like, do you think it was like an affront to their record? They hadn't
solved one. There had been 100 hijackings, but...
But, I mean, like, maybe I said it wrong. This was the first one that they hadn't been able to solve. Like, yeah. They put so many resources to it because they wanted to keep batting 1,000.
Like, they didn't want this to set the precedence that this could now be
done
and someone could escape.
Exactly.
Yeah, they had to, whether it was a dead body attached to a parachute, they had to show that either A, you couldn't do it and you'd die, or you couldn't get away with it because we'd catch you. And maybe that is why they poured so many. It was an open case for so long.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like they didn't bring it up. Like, it was, I'm sure, it was open till what, 2006, I think, is when it was open till?
Yeah. And there were constantly, and then evidence even came, like, stuff was found even after 2006.
So we'll get into that when we talk about the suspects. They didn't have anything for a really, really, really long time. And this wasn't for lack of trying. They searched through the forests. They went into that town of Ariel. They went door to door, door knocking, asking if anybody saw anything funny, if they had any suspicions of who it was. And there were people that they didn't have like any real understanding of what happened, but they'd be like, oh yeah, this guy might have been the guy. He's had some training. Like, they gave him a little bit of information to where they could kind of start pinning suspects.
Well, I mean, there were a lot of clues pointing to what knowledge this person had to even make this capable. First of all, they had to know that specific plane... Did you get him?
No, low risk, or high risk, low reward.
He had to know that this plane not only had the aft staircase, but that it could operate with it down to be able to parachute out of it. It's debatable if he had knowledge of parachutes because of what he may or may not have selected out of the parachutes. But the only people that had information about this plane and its ability were either Boeing employees, or there was a specific group within, I want to say it was either the FBI, no, it was the CIA. CIA is the one that operates overseas. A group in the CIA used this plane in Cambodia when we weren't supposed to be there, kind of like during the Vietnam era or Vietnam period.
Shocking.
Yes, and they used it to drop supplies out of this aft staircase of this plane. So this specific department or somewhat in the CIA knew that this could happen. So that's kind of also alluded to maybe this person had some inside information or some inside knowledge, whether it be an employee of Boeing or someone with the CIA.
Or an employee of that actual airline.
Yes.
That
had previous military service, wasn't it?
Somebody that would have had the ins and outs of how to fly, because you have to know not only about the airplane, but you have to know altitude, speeds, all those different things. Or somebody that was an experienced parachutist that could kind of put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't find really shit. And I think it was the sheriff of Ariel said, there's really two things here. Either we go out in deer season and somebody finds a body hanging from a parachute in a tree, or Mr. Cooper's sitting at home relaxing right now.
Yeah.
Like, they knew that it was probably a 50-50 shot of they were going to find.
Well, here's the deal, too. This is not, like, populated area of Washington. This is rural Washington, and if you're familiar with Washington, even southern Washington, there's a lot of trees, terrain. This was also a jump at night in less than desirable weather. So
during a rainstorm.
The authorities' kind of initial call on this was there was no way this guy could have survived. But they're still, they're like, it's likely he didn't survive, highly likely, but we're still going to pour all these resources into trying to find him a body.
I do wonder if he planned it, when he planned it, because this was right before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. So there was going to be a break and a holiday, and they may not have been able to do a lot of searching.
Have all the, like, government resources available to them at the time.
It could have been a crime of the time for that. So
the way that it was planned, I mean, it's planned with precision. Like, if anything, you have to be able to say, to make it, you know, believable that he may not have survived it, you have to try to poke holes and find out where in this plan he's reckless or he doesn't have experience. So, like, are you saying that he happened to know all of this about this plane, knew all of its capabilities, knew that he could jump and try to survive, only to not know how to operate a parachute? Is that what it's predicated on?
He just hoped that he failed into a success.
Yeah. Like, it seems like, and that's the thing, is nobody knows who this is, so you can't determine if this is the kind of person that just had a little bit of knowledge and then hoped it all worked out with that knowledge, or if they knew exactly what they were doing.
And he seemed to know.
Up to the point of him jumping, yes, yeah. He seemed to know exactly what he was doing.
And then it's a 50-50 shot whether you make it or whether you don't, mm-hmm. I think, because you can't take into account conditions and all that.
There's a lake near Ariel that was within the area that they thought he could have landed. There was, like, some rich millionaire, I can't remember where he was from, went and rented a submarine and went and explored the lake trying to find this.
That's awesome. That's pretty cool.
Sub trying to, yeah. But, like, what do you, it's cash. Like, what, you can't use radar or anything. Are you just hoping to stumble across, like, a parachute and a dead body attached to it with a stack of money?
Something that's floating down there in the water.
Well, I mean, and here's the thing, though, is that much cash that he had on him was pretty heavy, so I'm guessing that would have weighted him down.
200,000.
And because it's smaller denomination bills, it's going to be more.
$10,000 $20 bills?
Yeah. No, not 10,000. Oh, yeah.
If you take a zero off. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a hefty amount of money. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of
that'll
money.
That'll weight you down.
It's an anchor. This guy just blows my mind. I like him a lot, and just, it's the perfect crime. A couple days later, after their search is unsuccessful, there's a letter that comes into, I believe it's the Phoenix post office, and it was postmarked November 27th, and it came from Oakdale, California.
Oh, before you get to that real quick, just why it's not Dan Cooper that's known, it's D.B. Cooper. So part of the investigation, of course, the first thing these people do as part of their investigation is everybody within probably the Portland, Seattle area, because he made comments that made it sound like he was familiar with the area. Like when they were flying over to Tacoma, he was like, oh, it looks like Tacoma down there.
He pointed out Mount Rainier.
Yeah, there were certain things that he knew about the area. So they pretty much combed every Cooper in the area for questioning. And I think the news picked up that there was somebody named D.B. Cooper who was a suspect. I don't think he was actually a suspect. I think maybe just a name got leaked. But they started putting this guy in the press as D.B. Cooper. And so that's why the name was more popular. And then the FBI or whoever was investigating it was like, no, we're not going to correct anyone. Because if someone calls in with a tip about D.B. Cooper, we're going to know it's false because that's not the real name that people that had knowledge of the case would know. Someone calls in and says Dan Cooper, then that's going to tell us it's a good lead.
That's a solid thought process. Yeah. I would expect somebody of that caliber to be able to put that together.
Exactly. Right? That should be a common investigatory tool right there.
And they always, any sort of investigation, they leave out certain details because, like you say, only the people that are calling in the tips would know that, or only the perpetrator would know all of the dirty details that they would have. Mm-hmm. I like that. That's a good idea.
But I mean, despite them, there were 5 flights that were attempted with that SR-71 Blackbird. Now, this is like a high-level, top-secret military plane. This was approved by J. Edgar Hoover to allow these flights free of charge. The FBI was going to go ahead and cover it.
Fuck that guy.
For this, and they couldn't get any information out of any of these due to, like, low visibility. But it's just, it is so weird to think, like, that's what it says to me, is like, this case is going to be our make or break to either determine if skyjackings are going to go forward or if we're going to try to prove that these things aren't successful.
It didn't stop them, that's for sure.
No. But, I mean, they did searches. There was a bunch of evidence that has turned up. Let's go over the evidence and then, like, that's turned up, and then let's go to the suspects.
Okay.
So when was it that money was found?
the money was found in 1980. Okay. Do we want to not talk about the four letters that got sent out that were all the same?
Oh, no. Yeah, talk about that.
Yeah. So, first letter comes in, and it's very short. I don't really remember the details. Second letter comes in to Portland, and the FBI just assumed that these were pranks. Like, it was somebody that was sending different information just to either throw them off or be famous, whatever they wanted to do. Then, unfortunately for the FBI, there were 4 one-page letters that showed up. I think it was to Arizona, Nevada, Portland, and Seattle, or it might have been just a couple newspapers around those areas. Before the FBI realized kind of what they were, the newspapers read them off. They got the information out of them. And it was different things. Like, there was a part in there about how he didn't have a lot of time left, so they thought that he was either older or sick, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't kind of what you were talking about. I think it was a...
Was it close? To
yeah. It was a matter of months, I think.
But they thought that Dan Cooper was in his 40s, didn't they?
By the description that they got of him. So he was kind of explaining he didn't have a lot of time left. It wasn't a crime of passion or anything like that. It was a crime out of necessity. He didn't want to hurt anybody. And the FBI immediately was like, we need to seize all these letters. Before they could seize all the letters were printed in all these newspapers and everybody saw all the information. So it was kind of a miss at that point for the FBI of thinking the first couple were pranks, but these 4 of them were all...
Were they signed?
Legit. I think they might have been signed D.B. Cooper.
Hmm.
So
you have to take that with a grain of salt then, I think, because don't you think that Dan Cooper would know what the... You would have to say that Dan Cooper, whoever he was leaning into the D.B. Cooper thing to write these letters, or because that's how the nation knew him, that's no one else knew it was Dan Cooper. Maybe it was a way for them to filter that information.
Could be, and he could have put some other kind of Easter eggs in the letter that the FBI hadn't let out to believe that they were legitimate letters.
Well, and then also, like, they're doing a ton like that, the letters in 72 in March. So basically the FBI redid their calculations and determined that they were incorrect after doing an investigation with Northwest Orient. And they determined that it wasn't actually Ariel, but that the Cooper probably jumped over the town of La Center. And there was a report released in 2019. So like this shit still keeps coming
recent.
Up by the FBI. The report shows that approximately 3 hours after Cooper jumped, there was a burglary reported at a small grocery store in Hesse, Washington, which I'm guessing is close. It's an unincorporated community located within the calculated drop zone.
Ooh.
The burglar was noted by the FBI to only take in survival items such as beef jerky and gloves.
Fuck yeah, man. I like that.
So, I mean, there are things that, you know, could be coincidence, could be other things.
But they're still looking into it as recently as 2019.
Well, a report came out, but you also have the Freedom of Information Act, so someone could have just been combing through all that information
could have been
and just
a
found
FOIA
it. But
request from then.
That still had to have been something that they collected.
Yeah.
And so they had that information if it was with the FBI.
That's nuts. It's nuts just how much the FBI, like you said, and like we kind of talked about, they were putting a lot more resources into this, I think, that they were showing.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted to catch him, whether it be to push everybody else off or like this was just the one itch that they couldn't scratch and they had to just continue doing it. But either way, the way that it was all pulled off, whether it was successful or not, I want to believe it's successful. I think he did what he wanted to do. Mm-hmm. I think he's alive, or was alive. Maybe he is. Don't know.
Do you think he would stay in that area, that he was just someone from that area? Okay, mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying is, it seems like all of their searches are centered on with the predication that this was somebody local and they're just going to stay in the area.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not trying to get the fuck out as soon as they can.
Like, they tried to land in their home.
Yeah.
Basically, they tried to land in their front.
Someplace where they would have somebody, you know, somebody waiting for them or anything.
Yeah.
And they've continually done research to figure out flight plans working with different people. And there's been all these changes to, like, actually, we think he might have landed here. Actually, we might think. So they've done searches in all these areas. And then there were even areas they thought he could have landed that were close enough to Mount St. Helens that during the eruption in the 80s, it could have obliterated any other physical clues, which could have also meant if he died, his body.
Okay. I didn't think about his body. I just had always thought that the ash that covered in the area was enough to cover up any potential clues of ever getting found.
And that's what I'm saying, is it could have buried it, or if it's within that, you know, that cloud that destroys everything, that pyroclastic cloud from an eruption, the shockwave or whatever, if that was, you know, destroyed and buried whatever was remaining there. There was a situation where some kids were on their land, their farm, and they found a parachute. Nothing attached to it.
Mm.
But they called their dad out, and their dad was like, we got to call someone about this. Called someone, forwarded to the FBI. They came out and looked at it. They're like, this wasn't actually from, they thought it might have been actually from the D.B. Cooper case, but it turned out to be from a pilot who was like back in the 40s, like late 40s, when the United States had started developing jets, had to like bail out.
Oh.
Because they determined that D.B. Cooper's chute was nylon and this one was made of silk. Because that's what they used to make army. So they kind of ruled that out. But when did the money get found?
Money got found in 1980. And it was just by happenstance. It was an 8-year-old that was on the beach with his family along the Columbia River. And they wanted to build a fire pit. So as the dad was digging down into the sand, he kind of uncovered some things. And the 8-year-old's like, what is that? Takes a swipe at it. As soon as he takes a swipe at it, they find just these banded stacks of money.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately, like, oh.
They weren't in good shape.
No.
They'd been eaten, torn up, and stuff like that. Like, the time had, but it, I mean, it was a bound stack of discernible $20 bills.
It was still recognizable. It was pretty deteriorated, but they could still recognize the serial number. So they end up calling the FBI. FBI gets a hold of it. They take it in. Excuse me. They run the serial numbers that they're still able to see, and these serial numbers are matching up number for number with everything that they, not everything, excuse me, but a certain band that they had, and it ended up being $5,800, which I think they said that after a certain amount of time, they ended up either splitting with the family or they gave them
$3,200.
Is that what it was?
Like
$3,200. So they got a little bit from it, call it a reward or whatever for finding it. But that just renewed the effort around there. And the way that Washington works and Oregon works and all that is the Columbia River, I don't know what the origin is of it.
So the Columbia River, its origins are, I know that the Snake River flows into the Columbia River. The origins are somewhere between the border of Oregon and Washington. That's kind of what separates them for the longest time.
It does separate them.
But yeah, so you do have a ton of tributaries though. And I think, didn't they determine that there was a tributary near Ariel?
Yeah.
That if it landed in the water, it eventually with enough time, it could float its way down into the Columbia and end up there.
And it had many years because what this was...
It was buried too in sand. So how many years did the tide shift and push sand up into that bank and stuff like that?
And could the rest of it have floated out into the ocean? Because that's where the Columbia ends up. So where was, you know, anything along that beach there? They're looking for everything.
So that kid sold that money on eBay a few years back, and I think he got like $38,000 for it.
They gave them the actual money that they found?
Yeah.
Even though it was deteriorated and shitty? That's kind of fucked up. I thought it was just like an extra
$38,000. Maybe they gave them some regular money for it, and
they let them keep the...
And he got to keep like a, you know, a small stack of the D.B. Cooper money.
I hope so.
Well, in 78, a little bit before this, there was a placard printed with instructions for lowering the aft staircase of a 727 found by deer hunters near a logging road about 13 miles east of Castle Rock, Washington. Kind of like north of that whole Lake Merwin in... what's the name of it?
Ariel?
Ariel. So, but within the flight... 305's basic flight path. So there's all these, but think of also if there's high wind from that, I mean, it couldn't get that far from 10,000 feet, right?
Man, 10,000 feet, I think we're not, because that's almost 2 miles straight up in the air. I think there's a lot of drift.
I guess it's just weird to think that you're jumping from up there.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah.
Skydiving, I also don't understand.
All right. Let's get to the suspects.
Suspects are very cool to me because everybody has a little bit of, like, this has to be him.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there's just enough of, like, well, this doesn't make sense to kind of throw some different curveballs in there, if you will. What do you got for the three mains?
All right, so it is, I know Richard McCrory, and I know, I believe it's Kenneth Christensen. There was another one, I'm trying to remember his name. It's not the one you have written up there. It was another guy. Let me search for
it. It wasn't Robert Rackstraw?
No, it was. I probably should have been a little more prepared for this. I'm trying to think. The reason that I bring him up, I don't think he's one of the really well-known ones, but he was somebody who, I want to say was like talking to his wife on his deathbed and admitted to being Dan Cooper, and they got like in a fight, and then he died like nine days later. But she went back and she was remembering these times when they were driving through like Washington and he stopped the car and he just kind of just very unexpectedly and pointed to a section of trees and looked at his wife. He's like, "It's where D.B. Cooper walked out of the woods right there." And then they just kept going. And then there was also a situation where he stopped. I don't think this is relevant to that, but it's kind of strange. On the same trip, he had like stopped on a bridge, and I think it might have been like over the Columbia or something like that, and went to the back of the car and was fooling around with something and dropped something off the bridge, and then got back in the car and didn't say like another thing to his wife. I'm trying to remember what his name was.
What would it have to be, though?
Like, that's what I mean. That's why I don't like it's a it's something weird and suspicious, but it's not like I don't think it's tied directly to this case.
It could have been a box of vulvas for all we know.
That. Those have actually existed. So the one that I think, who do you think is the most likely, just from what you kind of went?
I don't think any of them are, honestly. I want to believe that this guy got away scot-free. Because I don't know
the amount of... these guys got away scot-free. These guys never got...
Some of them were still arrested for other things. But I don't know.
Okay, let's start with Kenneth. Okay. Kenneth Christensen. So Kenneth was a Minnesota resident, and he had a brother named Lyle. So in 2013, a lot of this stuff, like people have in jail have claimed to be D.B. Cooper. People outside of jail have claimed they get like tips. I think they said they had 1,000 suspects at one point.
Tons.
For who did this. And so you still get people like, over deathbed confessions, like I'm D.B. Cooper, like making allusions to it or information that their family finds about it coming up. So Kenneth Christensen, his brother Lyle in 2013 saw like a television series about it and became convinced that his brother who had previously died in 94 was Cooper. And there's like kind of a money grab situation where Lyle was trying to convince the FBI and then try to convince Nora Ephron, the author, or the film director, the one that did like Sleepless in Seattle, to like make a movie about his brother's life. The thing though that kind of has some weight to it in this situation is that Christensen was served in the armed forces, trained as a paratrooper. He had other training jumps that he did with like occupational forces in Japan. So he knew, you know, he knew at least how to jump out of a plane, whether that be if he ever gained any like recreational parachuting skills. I don't know if that's something he did with like an occupational, when he was serving with the occupational force in Japan. I don't know if they kept up on that. But he definitely had the training to do it. He was 45 at the time of the hijacking. He was shorter, like 5'8", and smaller than D.B. Cooper. He smoked as D.B. Cooper did, had a fondness for bourbon, which I don't think smoking and a fondness for bourbon are probably the best indicators. I think a lot of people probably like to smoke.
Synonymous.
But there was actually the main thing that tied it was that they showed his pictures to Schaffner, and something about him, she was like, "I think you need to look into this. I think you might be onto something on this." But
was he the one that worked for the airline?
He might have been, actually.
There was one of them that had worked for the airline, and they said that the clip-on tie was fairly close to what the male uniform was for the airline. And I'm not positive that this was the one. It might have been McCoy that had it. But I do know that one of them was a worker for that airline.
Well, the thing about McCoy is, so he was also, and I think they did first look at people that had parachuting experience, and where's the only place in the 70s that you're going to have parachuting experience?
Army.
Yeah. Widespread parachuting experience. Like, you might have to question pilots or like recreational skydivers, but I don't know how you'd even really find those people.
I think it would almost lend more towards somebody that pursued it after being out of the military, though, because to know the difference between a recreational parachute and a military parachute, you kind of have to be versed in both.
Well, actually, here's the thing is McCoy actually, so he did two tours of duty in Vietnam. After his military service, he worked for the Utah National Guard, and he was an avid recreational skydiver.
Very interesting.
There was also, he was the one that did the copycat hijacking. So, and he did the exact same thing. He boarded a Boeing 727 with the stairs. He did it. He requested $500,000. And after the delivery of the money and the parachutes in San Francisco, he ordered the craft back into the sky and then jumped out over Utah. But he was also arrested.
One of the reasons that I think that it wasn't him was he also, one of the ways that he got attention with the flight attendant was he flashed a gun. And so he,
in his skyjacking.
Yep. So he brought a gun onto the plane where his DB was just solely dependent on the bomb. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, obviously this is only one crime. So it's like just a micro example of what could have been, but a gun, like introducing a gun into a crime like that doesn't seem like something you would do if you were just heavily relying on a bomb and not trying to threaten more than like the mass explosion. Like a gun, there's a bevy of things that could happen. You could shoot a suspect or you could shoot a witness, something like that. But DB didn't bring a firearm. He was just solely dependent on the bomb.
Well, and I think, you know, all of these suspects have a couple things that could tie them to it. There's not someone that matches, you know, the full description or matches enough of it to make them, you know, a serious candidate. There was this guy named Sheridan Peterson. He was also a soldier. He was employed as a technical editor at Boeing. So he would have had knowledge of the plane. He also had experience with parachuting because he was a smoke jumper. So now this one, you're getting three ties into it. He already had the previous experience as a parachuter. He worked for Boeing, and he was also based in the Seattle area.
So it wouldn't have been a long drive home. He would have been familiar with everything around there.
I mean, not a huge drive home, but you're still in southern, you know, southern Washington, so you're still taking a drive.
You're still in the, like, you still understand, like, the geography of Washington, though. Mm-hmm. Like, you're a resident.
Well, what was the thing with Robert Rackstraw? Because he was like a career criminal, right?
Rackstraw, to me, feels like maybe the closest just because he was kind of a rapscallion of sorts. He became kind of a suspect for the Cooper case in 1978 because he was arrested for check kiting in Iran. And he had been arrested kind of for passing bad checks. And they were looking for him. He ended up over in Iran, and when he went in to renew the visa that he had, that's when they picked him up in Iran. Our relations with them were probably a lot better back then. He also was in possession of explosives, so that's kind of another tip. He was deported back to the United States, and he was in prison, but he was released on bail a couple months after that. So that seems very weird, as maybe the FBI like didn't look at him as close, and it spurred a lot of controversy because this dude, he was a, I believe he was in the military too. Before all this happened, he tried to fake his own death by calling for a false mayday message over an airplane radio. And he said that he was jumping out of a compromised vehicle. So he tried to fake his death that way, which jumping out of a compromised vehicle.
To get out of the military?
I think that's what it was, yeah. And they found him in California after that. The plane that he said that he had abandoned the mayday call was found in the hangar. So he obviously wasn't great at covering his tracks there. He was found guilty of forging a federal pilot certification. His criminal past involving airplanes, along with the serial military and parachute experience, led investigators to believe Rackstraw was a prime suspect. He wasn't ever associated with it for like another 37 years. So this was, they saw all this stuff, but then they let him go out on bail.
What's so crazy too about this is how many suspects there are, because so many people had skill sets that would have lent themselves to this in the 70s. like, we have all these people. So do you think that, I mean, was that the brilliance of Dan Cooper, is he had the foresight to see that
it wasn't,
his skill set wasn't so specific uncommon. That, well, it was uncommon, but like, once you start digging into it, the FBI was like, there's a lot of fucking people who could have done this.
Part of the letters that he wrote too said that he used face putty to alter his appearance. And he said that he disguised himself in a certain way with like a toupee and other things like that. So it sort of broadens the pool of suspects to kind of like height, weight, and age, because everything else about the facial looks, you don't know if that was a fake nose, a fake chin, or anything like that.
I would think that, like, even like facial putty, I would think back then with like Tina Mucklow sitting so close to him, she would have probably noticed if there was something looked a little bit odd.
Was it a red herring that he mentioned that too? Like, was that his actual look and appearance, but he was trying to shake them off that? There's a million different ifs about this.
It's the lack of evidence and like the amount of skills that all had to fall into place for this to happen. Like, what's the likelihood? Separate what you hope happened and what the likelihood is. Do you think he survived jumping out of the plane?
I would give him 50-50 on it. Okay. Just because of the conditions.
That's what I was going to say. 50-50 on that. So then the fun part is, you know, on the 50-50 board, 50 of that is the story ends there. And then his body's just sitting out there, maybe destroyed by an eruption or something like that. Which,
floating out to the ocean.
Can you imagine that if you give him the choice, being like, you're going to die, but then your body's going to be destroyed in a volcanic eruption. Sold. Or you're going to make it down to Mexico. After you jump out of here, you're going to walk out of the woods, find a car, hightail it down south of the border.
It's high risk, high reward for sure.
Mm-hmm. So here's the thing, though. Do you think that with all of the stuff that came about because of this, metal detectors now being installed in airports, TSA was created to go ahead and, you know, search everyone's bag and had that authority. If you came in to buy an airplane ticket same day, you had to go through a lot more verification of your identity in order to do that. What I think it even kind of made one-way plane tickets have to have more scrutiny, everything. But the fact that this guy got away with that, despite 50-50 chance he died, it changed this entire thing. They had no choice but to say, yeah, we can't find this guy. Maybe he died, but just because there was the chance that he didn't, they had to completely alter the whole thing. So this is what he did, because no one was hurt, is exceptionally cool. What came about because of it is insanely inconvenient, but obviously based on the 100 hijackings in 3 years was very necessary. Like, had it been done after the 50th hijacking, D.B. Cooper would have never happened.
No, and I think we see that with every kind of tragedy that's happened while flying, because I don't think TSA was necessarily as big of a thing. It definitely wasn't as big of a thing before 9/11.
Oh, no, that, definitely not. I mean, changed still, the game. But it was big enough, though, that you couldn't sneak. I mean, look what they had to use on 9/11 was the box cutter knives.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how much research had to go into the fact that a box cutter knife didn't set off a metal, because that's not their first trial run going through those metal detectors with it. They're going to plan all that time and then get caught because it sets off. They had to know. So, I mean, even at that point, TSA was down to the point where that's all that they could get on. Mm. They couldn't get an actual knife on or anything like that. But then after that, TSA was just like, nope, fuck it. No more mouthwash, no more toenail cutters or anything like that.
Well, and then the shoe bomber is the reason.
That's the chemical one, isn't it? That's the reason that you can't take the more than 3 ounces of a chemical.
I think so, because when they found him, he was in the back of the plane literally trying to light his shoe on fire.
And now we all have to take off our goddamn shoes going through security.
Yeah, I think there's just evolutionary steps, and he was definitely the first one to be like, whoa, we need to take a look at this. To put on a full-on conspiracy cap, which this one I just kind of have to, because it's just so low risk, I think that D.B. Cooper either was a member of the government, as far as like FBI, whatever, or I think that he had done something in his past Army life. I think it could have been any of these guys that had past Army experiences, where they were flying like black missions or something that...
It was Vietnam. There was a lot of that shit going on. That's when the CIA was like out in the field getting dirty and everything.
I think that there's a great chance that this guy was affiliated with something that the government didn't want getting out, or that he was a member of the government. And when they found him and they came across him, he bargained for the ability to get out of it. And then in order to keep a good front that this didn't happen, because like I say, Rackstraw was let out after check kiting in Iran, faking his death, doing just all this horrible shit. He was let out after 3 months on bail and never put back in jail. So was it Rackstraw that had done some bad military things, or was a member of a secret FBI organization?
Well, here's the thing, though, too, is if they knew who it was or they had this, the public would never know if they were part of these, like, secret, like, missions or, like, these secret groups.
It's the perfect crime to get away with for the government to do that, because you want to put on a good face, like, hey, we're still out there looking for him. We're going to keep this investigation open into the 2000s, like... It's a long con play to fool everybody that they may have had somebody that was either involved with the government or had done things for the government. So are you saying that
D.B. Cooper, whoever he was actually caught after this, but then bargained for his release?
What was
his bargaining chip then?
That he had this information that...
Why didn't they just kill him?
Well, if he's got a situation where his wife knows about it too, and he says, if I don't come back from this, go ahead and mail these letters out.
Everyone was... CIA would just kill people.
Yeah.
I like the fact, up until the point where he got caught and released, I do like the thought that he had experience doing this, and that's why they poured so many resources into trying to catch him, is because they had an idea who he was, but I don't think they ever caught him, because I think if he did have any of that experience, he would have to get out of the country. He would know that that was his chance at escape. So... if he did survive, I'm saying he made it to find a car and hightailed it. And
if he really honestly was sick, he might have just died off before they got a hold of him, and then they kind of knew.
I don't want to believe that. I want to believe because no one was hurt. This is like one of those Robin Hood type situations.
I full on hope that he got away with it. Mm-hmm. I hope that he lived out a great life on the beach somewhere and got one over on the government without harming
anyone. Was it without a paddle?
Where they
go to search for D.B. Cooper's money.
Great movie. Mm-hmm. Who is it? Dax, Seth Green. Matthew Lillard
and Seth Green, yeah. Good. They all go looking for D.B. Cooper's money.
Good movie.
They find D.B. Cooper, don't they?
He's living up in the woods.
Yes, who plays him? I want to say Gary Busey, but I know it's not Gary Busey.
No, Gary Busey is the weirdo that lives in the woods in Black Sheep.
That's right. Well, maybe he was typecasted in that. All right, let's see.
They also find the hippie chicks.
Yeah, and then one of them ends up staying. Let's see. Who plays D.B. Cooper?
2009.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago. Great movie, though.
Man, I'm not finding who's playing D.B. here. Why do they have him so far down the...
Just uncredited?
It's not Burt Reynolds, is it? It is. Remember, he goes by a different name, and then they... find out he's actually D.B. Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's Bert.
They tried to bury him in here, too. Maybe it actually was Bert Reynolds or whoever played him, and they just had the inside track on it.
Yep, I'm pretty sure. Let's see who it is. Let's see. I know I'm just trying to fill here. The trio escapes. Cooper's crash landing. Discovers his cell. Oh, that's right. So they discovered D.B. Cooper's skeleton. Spoiler alert. Burt Reynolds is his partner. The one that was D.B. Cooper. And then he gives some of the money to him. And then, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that still movie, still a funny 90s movie.
Still holds up. Sure. 2000s.
Yeah.
2009.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Jesus, my timing is off.
That's getting old.
All right, man. Well, you got anything else on this guy?
No, I hope that DB lived a great life.
It's one of those rare crimes that you can just look at and be like, no stakes.
Like you said, Robin Hood, he stole from the rich and he didn't give to the poor. Maybe he was might
have
poor.
Been poor and he was just giving it to himself. And some kids found his money. So if that family didn't have much money.
Win-win.
Yep. I like to imagine he's like the Andy Dufresne character.
Got a way to send Watanabe.
Uh-huh. Red was there. Or after Red got released, then he showed up and there was Andy.
Some sweet old black man showed up and D.B. Cooper was working on the boat.
Mm-hmm. Is it what the nail? All right, man. Well, thanks again for joining us, guys, and see you later.
Peace.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for joining us for another episode. If you like what you heard, hit that subscribe and like button. Follow us. If you didn't like what you heard, still hit that anyway, because we'll probably cover something in the future that you do like. Please follow us on our social media. Adam, hit them with it.
Our Instagram is Historically High Pod, Historically High POD, and we are on Twitter at Historically High, that's Historically HI.
All right. And if you guys want to send in any feedback, suggestions, hit us up on those two, or you can even do it on Gmail. It's historicallyhighpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again.
Peace.